here.
Nice.
Okay, so this is Bio 231, and it's Monday, February 3rd. And I've had a lot of questions regarding Blackboard. In particular, sometimes people log on and this menu on the left-hand side goes away. And they think, well, maybe there's something wrong with the server or the program or whatever. But you can hide this frame or you can get it to appear. So if you just grab this edge like this, see that arrow? And if you click on that arrow, like it goes away and you can't go anywhere. So that can be a difficulty for some people. Right, unless you know what? If you go over here and just hover in this area, you get the arrow back and you can get the menu back. Yeah?
I wouldn't want to ask that question, but my problem was the HTML wasn't that issue.
Okay, I don't know. I've never heard of that. I've heard of HTML, but I don't know why it wasn't. It sounds like an internet connection problem. Internet connection. Were you here on campus or somewhere else?
I was in my house, right? Multiple computers.
Okay, I hadn't heard that there's something wrong, but there could be something wrong. There's been a lot of things wrong with computer systems around here. Well, thank goodness it's back, so make sure you guys start progressing through some of the activities in Blackboard, and it would be a good idea to get that syllabus quiz done because it's going to go away on Thursday, and your first assignment, you have two assignments, two quizzes to take by Thursday, Chapter 1 and Chapter 2, so get started with that. A lot of times, students won't show up to class at the beginning or maybe somewhere along the line in the semester and they're shooting for like an F in the class. And so I would like to drop them. But a lot of times, I don't know if a student wants to be dropped or not. So if you don't want me to be confused or drop you by accident, make sure you keep logging into Blackboard, right? Because I can tell when you log in, when you do stuff, and I'll always check that record before I drop somebody, and I'll also check the sign-in sheet. So here's the sign-in sheet for today. That's your receipt that you're in class. Make sure you sign that. All right, so that's it for Blackboard. Any other questions? Any other questions? Yes?
I'm trying to find the
campus sheet for the reading. Okay, let's see. See if I can figure that out. So pre-lecture reading assignments right here. Let me click on that, and it loads the next page. Hopefully, we don't just get HTML gobbledygook. Here, pre-lecture homework answer keys. So they should be in there, and they should be popping open sometime during that particular lecture. So there should be at least one open right now for Chapter 1. Maybe even for Chapter 2 is open. Let's check and see. All right, so click on that. And Chapter 1 is available. There it is. And Chapter 2 is available right there. And Chapter 3, item is not available, will be available after February 5th because we get two lectures on tissues. So on Wednesday at 12 p.m. that will show up, but not ahead of time because I want you guys to think about that stuff. All right, well, our SI leader is putting some important contact information on the board. So jot that down, but also, since we're in Blackboard, I intend to get that in supplemental instruction button here pretty quickly. All right, so I think I have it, but in case I don't have it, how is it that I can always get it? I can use my cell phone. And I'm just going to take a quick picture of this. All right, so this is the first week for SI. I think I can get it. Mostly. Okay. Yes.
Again, you
know
I know you have the keys.
Yeah.
I forgot where to find the assignments after. So, no, I know they're not due. Where are they?
Okay, the pre-lecture reading assignments? Yeah, let's check that out. Okay, so look in the left-hand frame. All right, so let me close all these things away because you don't have to worry about that. Here's that left-hand frame, and you want to look for pre-lecture reading assignments. There it is right there. So how far is it down? It's not in the first section, but it's right at the top of the second section. Pre-lecture reading assignments, and they're in their own folder in that button. So here's the folder, pre-lecture reading assignments, and they are all there. All right, so for the rest of the semester, they're there. Just the answer keys aren't there yet. But that's been, they've been I automated them to open up right after lecture. And if I programmed it wrong, just give me an email and I'll open them back up so that you can get them. All right, so that automation was just done by a human, so that could mean that there are mistakes in there. All right. Oh, I had another question. Actually, I had a bunch of questions on this one. And the question is, I'm studying the book, and there's something on page such and such, like 439X, and is that going to be on the exam, even though we didn't cover it in lecture? Or I'm studying this over here, and you know it's not in your lecture. I'm wondering if that's going to be on the exam. So how do you know if something's on the exam or not? What is your, basically it's your contract with me. What do you know to study? The exam study guide, right? So just pull that out. Page numbers are there. Figure numbers are there. The figures are there that you have to label. End of chapter questions, online practice questions. You have a lot of things to practice in Blackboard. That will just develop your familiarity with the language and the concepts, right? But anything that's not in that list, then you're not responsible for. Or if I trick you and I put it on the test, then I would have to delete it from the test somehow or another. All right, so that's lecture. What about lab? What's my contract with you for lab? You have the answer key in your possession. It is the lab manual, right? Your lab manual is the answer key for the lab practicums. So if I put something on a practicum that's not in your lab manual, then that's a really dirty trick for you guys, and I'll take it off the test, right? Or make it extra credit or something like that. So those are the two things you should really be studying. Okay, plus, don't forget, this is a hybrid class, which means that you should be learning a lot of things online. And there are a lot of excellent drag and drop exercises. There's a lot of videos over here in the practicums. So you should be reviewing that information because we're not requiring you to be in class like a typical on-campus lecture or a typical on-campus lab. So that's all I know about that. Any other questions? We're good? All right, so we were I think we got done with mitochondria last time. All right, so here is a picture of the whole cell. And where is my word slide? Ah, here it is. All right, so I'm going to put that up over here. We're talking about mitochondria. And what was one really strange thing you learned about mitochondria last time? Something really strange. Maybe it freaked you out. I hope it freaked you out. Ooh. Used to be a bacteria. That's right. So we're not really, you think you're you, but you're really what? A symbiosis. And you have these mitochondria that are producing ATP, and basically they infected this kind of cell once upon a time, and that set up that interesting symbiosis. So mitochondria have DNA, have cytoplasm, and it has a membrane around itself, so that's really a living cell all by itself. It can no longer live by itself, these right here, because it has evolved to live inside the cell. There are cells that have a nucleus behind a cell membrane. We call those eukaryotic cells. When their genetic material is in a nucleus behind a membrane, there are still a few eukaryotic cells that have a nucleus that do not have mitochondria. They're very, very rare. They're very ancient types of cells, but we still can find them in certain locations. Right? This is really a nice modern cell. You have eukaryotic cells. Okay, well, what's the next organelle that I want to talk about? I think I talked about this in lab. Centrioles. Centrioles control the microtubule system and the microfilament system inside of a cell. So I see some microfilaments right here. And you can see them all going back to this centriole or centrosome complex. And each one of these tubes acts like a railway. And it only has one rail. And, of course, you know what that's called. What do you call a railway that has just one rail? Monorail. Where could you go see one? Disneyland Hotel. And then you can hop a ride to Disneyland or whatever is over there. So organelles are positioned within the cell because they attach to these microtubules, or if they want to change their positions, they can move around, right? These microtubules can move them around inside the cell. And as a matter of fact, some of these microtubules attach to the cell membrane, and it can move the membrane around and change the shape of the cell. Some people that have lab this morning know three basic shapes of cells. What are, anybody remember what are the three basic cells by shape? especially in an epithelium. Anybody remember? I hear squamous. Yeah, what does squamous mean?
Flat.
A flat cell. So these microtubules push and pull, and so the cell is really flat. What's another kind?
Cuboidal.
Some cells are more cuboidal. They're about as wide as they are deep, as they are tall. So we call those a cuboidal. And the third kind is?
Columnar.
It's about as wide as it is deep, but it is what? Way tall. Really, really tall. That's a columnar cell. Determined by the centrioles and the microtubules attached to other proteins in the cell membrane. Okay, cilia and flagellum. This cell doesn't have any of them, so I can't really describe, but some of these microtubules and some cells project way outside the cell, right? And what's the job of these microtubules again? They can move things around, right? These microtubules go up into a certain extension of the cell, and it can move those extensions around. Some small ones are called cilia. So the important thing about cilia, you want to write down motility. Motility. So some cells have cilia, they can move around. Not human cells, but some unicellular organisms swim by cilia that are sweeping. Right? We do have ciliated cells in our body. They're anchored, so they can't move around. They have cilia that are beating all the time. They're sweeping stuff that's on the surface. So even the cells can't swim around. They're moving stuff over the surface. We'll take a look at that. And a flagellum is a single, really long. It's like a cilium, except there's only one on a human cell, and it's probably maybe 20 times longer. And again, what a flagellum is, the same thing for cilia, we're going to say, just a bullet point is, motility. Right? And that flagellum will move that cell around in a watery environment. Anybody have a picture in their mind what kind of human cell has a flagellum? A sperm cell. That's right. So you ladies, you don't have any cells in your body with a flagellum. Okay? The way it goes. You have the genetic material to build them, it's just not revealed, it's just not put to work. Okay, microvilli is even smaller than the cilia. It's not for motility, it's for absorption. So microvilli allow things to, or help the movement of material from inside the cell to the outside, or probably even better, from the outside to the inside of the cell. So absorption is the job of microvilli. And this term micro right here just means that they're what? Really, really small. Maybe we could find them in lab, maybe not. All right, so that's mostly it for the organelles. Don't forget, what's the building block of life? Cells. And a cell has to have what? Plasma membrane? What else does it have to have? Genetic material, right? And if it's in a nucleus, that's even better, but it just has to have genetic material. And then what else? Cytoplasm. Yeah, cytoplasm. And what is cytoplasm? It has two parts. Cytoplasm has, like what I'm pointing here, what is this thing called, and this thing, and this thing, and this thing. These are organelles. And then all of this fluid between organelles is cytosol. So cytoplasm is made of organelles and cytosol. And cytoplasm is all this junk between the plasma membrane and the nuclear membrane. It's all this stuff right here. A lot of living processes going on. Okay, I want to move on with lecture, nuclear structures, but I got to talk about one other thing. Okay, the bullet point for mitochondria. What do mitochondria do for us? We know what we do for them, right? We give them oxygen, we protect them from other things that want to eat them, bacteria, viruses, things like that. But what do we get from mitochondria? ATP, very important molecule. That's the energy molecule that keeps us alive. And in order to make ATP, mitochondria need oxygen, which is the reason why we inhale. And if we stop delivering oxygen to them, they stop producing ATP, which is the energy inside our cells. When your cells run out of energy, what happens to them? They die. That's right. So ATP is kind of a nice chemical symbol for life inside of a cell. And every once in a while, somebody maybe has a heart attack, their heart stops beating. Blood stops going to the brain. No oxygen is going to the brain. How long can your brain function without oxygen? Because the mitochondria stop making ATP. How long can your brain function without ATP? Anybody know? Probably some people that took CPR. When my heart stops, when do I pass out? Because my brain stopped functioning. Okay? 2 to 3 seconds. 2 to 3 seconds. That's how important ATP is and those mitochondria. And if you wait a long enough period of time and your brain doesn't get oxygen, then those cells are going to die. How long can your brain go, an adult brain, go without oxygen before it dies? 2 to 3 seconds, you lose consciousness. They stop functioning, but you probably still can get them back to life. But when do they die? When can't you ever get them back? Right? That's what death means. It means that you can't come back to life. So when does your brain die? 2 to 3 seconds, your brain runs out of ATP. 2 to 3 minutes, and the brain is dead. Right? So that's how important ATP is. Super, super important. And what organelle inside the cells make ATP for us? Mitochondria. Yeah, mitochondria. That's super important to know. Okay. Well, this plasma membrane keeps the living things inside the cell, keeps non-living matter outside, unless the cell needs to have it, like maybe a glucose molecule, right, can enter the cell. So we're really interested in movement across this plasma membrane. It's a special doorway to move things in and out of the cell. So plasma membrane, what's the basic building block of a plasma membrane? It is the phospholipid bilayer, right? And that's, you can add proteins to that and other kinds of molecules, and then you want to think of it not just as a phospholipid bilayer, but with the, what, fluid mosaic model inside your mind. And your book has a really good picture of that. So how can we move things across the cell membrane, or how do cells do it? There are two basic ways. Sometimes a passive transport process works. Passive means does not require ATP. It just happens automatically. For instance, if I had a perfume bottle right here and I opened it up, that perfume would evaporate into the room. And even though there's no fan here, guess what would happen to that perfume? Would you ever be able to smell it? Yeah. So that perfume molecule would first move to you, and then the second row and third row, and eventually it's going to find its way all the way to the back of the room. We call that diffusion. When something goes from a high concentration to low concentration, that's diffusion, does not require ATP. And there has to be a concentration difference, a gradient in concentration. So for a passive movement, how do things have to go in terms of concentration, from where to where? High concentration to low. So when I open that bottle up, high concentration by the bottle. As soon as I open that bottle up, what's the concentration in the back of the room? Zero. High concentration gradient means that molecule is going to move pretty fast. All right. Well, I did that Friday, and I forgot to put a cap in the bottle. Right. And we walked in here on Monday. Is there any diffusion taking place anymore? And I would like you to appreciate that there's no longer diffusion, because if that perfume was here all weekend, then a bunch of perfume went up to the back of the room. The concentration of perfume in the back is equal to the concentration here in the front. And what does diffusion need? Concentration gradient. Somewhere it's got to be high, somewhere it's got to be low. And if it's all the same concentration, there's no high or low. So then diffusion stops. So diffusion is dependent on that concentration gradient. Osmosis is just a special form of diffusion. So is osmosis, is it passive, no energy, or active? Does it require energy? No requirement, right? It's a passive process. It's a special kind of diffusion, right? There's only one molecule that can osmose. Many thousands, millions of molecules can diffuse, but only one molecule can osmose, and that is water. So osmosis deals with the solvent molecule, and in us, what are we dissolved in? What are we? We're just a bag of stuff dissolved in water. Okay, so water is the only molecule that can osmose, right? And the other criteria for osmosis is that it has to go through a semi-permeable membrane, a membrane that sometimes lets some stuff in, but not everything. So that would be osmosis. Right? Water across, for instance, the plasma membrane. It's just a special case of diffusion. It's still a passive process. Right, now, so which way can water go if it's moving across this membrane right here? If it's passive, which way, how does it go in terms of concentration? Only from high concentration to low concentration. Right, it's just going to move like that, kind of magically. It does not require energy. But we do have a number of processes in our body that do require energy. We call those active processes. And the energy molecule that's used is ATP. And we see ATP can be converted into an ATP. I'm sorry, ATP has three phosphate atoms. That's what this phosphate is. That T stands for three or tri. Right, it has three phosphate atoms. One of these phosphates can break off. It ends up over here, leaving this adenosine with only two, or ADP. There's energy in that chemical bond that is released when ADP is formed from ATP. That energy then is used for all kinds of nifty things inside your body, like muscle contraction, sending nerve impulses around, building things, or maybe even secreting things outside of the cell, right? Which is what we call an active process. Active processes go the opposite way compared to passive, which means that a molecule can go from low concentration to high concentration. Right? Low concentration to high. But it's going to require energy. Like, how did all that perfume get in the bottle at one point in time? Could you just open up a bottle and all the perfume run in? No, you needed some kind of mechanism that requires energy to grab a perfume molecule and put it in the bottle. Right? And grab another one, put it in the bottle. So if there's low concentration in the back of the room, high here, there's got to be some kind of process that requires energy to grab those perfume molecules and stick them back in the bottle. Perfume manufacturers know how to do that. I don't know how to do that. Okay. So that's an active process. That would be an example of molecular transport, just one molecule at a time. There are other kinds of active transport. We call these macromolecular transport. And of course, do these require energy? Phagocytosis, pinocytosis, exocytosis? Yes, because they're active. All right, so let's look at these membranes inside the cell. Here is some endoplasmic reticulum, but you should know what kind it is. What kind of endoplasmic reticulum is this? Rough. What's the function of rough, ER? Make proteins, right? And those proteins end up inside these membrane systems right here. Right? So the job of endoplasmic reticulum is to make proteins that eventually end up in these vesicles. So there are some proteins trapped in a little bud of this endoplasmic reticulum, and it breaks away from the ER, hops a ride on a microtubule, it's carried over to this thing right here. I think we talked about that. That is a Golgi body, Golgi apparatus. The job, anybody remember what the job of Golgi apparatus is? Modification and packaging. So it takes hold of that protein, maybe adds a sugar molecule to it, making it a mucopolysaccharide, and it changes the structure of that molecule, which means what? Changes the function of that molecule, right? If it's a mucopolysaccharide, that kind of gives you a hint of what it does, right? Here's mucopolysaccharide, but it doesn't belong inside the cell, it belongs outside the cell. So what happens? Golgi body pinches off a little vesicle, vesicle hops a ride on microtubule, comes over to the plasma membrane, uses with the plasma membrane, like we see here, okay, and all those particles that were inside the cell are now where? Outside the cell. That's a secretory process. That's an example of exocytosis. Cyto means cell, cytosis means a process of the cell, exo means leaving, right? So that's pretty easy to understand. That requires energy for that to happen. So this sometimes we call a secretory pathway, starting with rough ER, Golgi, into a secretory vessel, and then finally being released from inside the cell. So think of a little motion picture right here. You got some other things in your chapter to help you see that, maybe something in Blackboard as well. So a molecule can go from high concentration inside the cell to low concentration outside. What do we call that process? Going from low concentration to high, low to high. That's active, right? Requires ATP. Where does ATP come from? Mitochondria, right here. Okay. So here are a couple other examples. Phagocytosis is the reverse of exocytosis. That's when something is on the outside of the cell. The plasma membrane forms an invagination or a dimple. Those particles get into that dimple. And then finally, the plasma membrane forms around those particles, forms a vesicle. It breaks away from the plasma membrane. And then you have a vesicle with stuff on the inside of it that used to be on the outside. Right? And again, that stuff can go from low concentration to high concentration inside the cell. If it's a particle, a large particle, we call that phagocytosis. Maybe if it's a molecule that can't really dissolve in water, but it's there. It's a suspension in water. That's phagocytosis, or cell eating. Cytosis, cell process. Phago means eat. All right. Pinocytosis is that same process where the cell takes something up, but it is not a solute. It's not something dissolved. No, it is something dissolved in water. Right. So the cell is taking up water and some stuff dissolved in water. That's called cell drinking, pinocytosis. That requires energy as well. All right, so everything that the rough endoplasmic reticulum makes that ends up in a vesicle doesn't end up outside the cell. It's not secreted. Sometimes those vesicles, I see one here, I see one here, right? And here's one that's just forming right there, or another one that's forming right here. Sometimes these vesicles stay inside the cell. And they have different names. I would probably like for you to know the names of two of them. Sometimes one of them contains an enzyme that can detoxify harmful compounds in your body. So the cell does produce some toxic compounds, and your cell gets rid of them because it has a peroxisome. Ah, peroxisome right here. A peroxisome, what's the job of a peroxisome, if you're going to say it in one word? Detoxification. Yeah, put that in your notes or on this slide. Detoxification. Here I see another vesicle. Where is it named? It's got to have a name on here someplace. I just don't see it. It's not a peroxisome. There's probably no way you can tell. I don't know. Maybe you can tell. I don't know if there's a difference in color of these things, but they're both, what, spherical? So I won't ask you which one is which, but I do want you to know that a peroxisome is for detoxification. Other kinds of vesicles we call a lysosome. Oh, here it is, lysosome. Right? And a lysosome is filled with lysozyme. That's an enzyme that can digest other large molecules. So the function of lysosome is digestion. Function of peroxisome is detoxification. So those would be good, nice bullet points for you to remember for those two vesicles. And can you tell the difference between, like, this one here and this one up over here? Are they different color or anything? This one here, they aren't. You just have to know the function of them. So this is an exam figure. You would probably have to know how to label all of these lead lines. Like when I erase these names and I see this lead line going to that little dot there and this little dot there. And on the test, you'd have to tell me what that is. And that is these are ribosomes. And you know the function of a ribosome is to make protein, right? So it's protein synthesis. All right. What did I just say? Protein synthesis. All right, well, that came up on lecture notes. I don't think I have much in the way of slides for protein synthesis, so I'm just going to talk about it a little bit. And we have genetic material inside the nucleus, which determines the shape of all of these organelles, except for mitochondria. They work by themselves. And if the genetic material inside the nucleus determines the structure of all these things, what is it really determining? The function of all these different organelles, right? If it's in control of the structure, it's in control of the function. So the nucleus controls both the structure and the function of the cell. Very important information. All right, well, how does it do that? All right, it makes structures called proteins. You know what a building block of a protein is? Probably. Maybe you've heard of amino acid. That's a basic building block of a protein. What's a building block of life, once again? A cell. Okay. So we like to think of building blocks a lot in this class. And it's this genetic material that can tell the cell how to put amino acids together to make a particular kind of protein. Sometimes the instruction is to put maybe 4 amino acids together, maybe 10 or maybe 1,000. It changes the shape of that protein, which means what? The function of a 3 amino acid protein is a lot different than a 4, different than a 5, different than a 1,000, right? So how does that happen? Well, we said that information in DNA is very important. Without it, the cell is going to die. So it's protected behind this nuclear membrane right here. Well, how does that information get out into the cell? What organelle needs that information to make a protein? What organelle makes protein? Ribosomes. Ribosomes need that information. How does that information go from the nucleus to a ribosome so that the cell can make protein? This is how, right? And this is called the central dogma in biology. And a dogma is just a set of way to think. It's a set of statements that can never be questioned. That is always right, no matter where you are. You're in a different universe, it's always right, no matter what. And you're scientists, okay? Do you understand that to be true? Is there something that can be right all the time that you should never challenge, being a scientist? And the answer is no. You should always challenge information, right? You should always challenge authority, because that's how progress is made. All right, but nonetheless, we're going to start with this statement right here. This statement says that information in DNA, okay, is going to move. And you see an arrow here. Which way does this arrow go? It's pointing to RNA, okay, and is it a double-ended arrow or a single-ended arrow? Single, which means information goes from DNA to RNA. What about RNA to DNA? Answer is no. With, according to what? The central dogma in biology. Okay, that RNA then leaves the nucleus, some of it through these pores. Sometimes it's actively transported out of the nucleus, and it hooks up with a ribosome, and then the information in RNA is converted into information in a protein, which is what? Just how many amino acids should be put in that protein, and maybe the sequence, because there's 20 different kinds of amino acids, what amino acids should be put there first, which one should be in the second location, third location, etc. That requires information. Just like if you want to spell a word, what do you use? What's the building block of a word? Letters, right? And if you change the order of letters or the sequence of letters in a word, what are you changing? The meaning. You're changing the function of that word, the meaning of the word, right? All right, so information goes from DNA, which is always inside the nucleus, to RNA, which can leave, and then RNA is used to make a protein. And what about this arrow, RNA to protein? Does it go backwards? No, it's one direction. All right, so to make a protein, how many steps does it take?
Three.
I see one arrow. I see two arrows. There are two steps to make a protein. All right, and can a protein ever be used to make RNA? Can a protein ever be used to make RNA and then DNA?
No.
No, it can't, because you see these two processes just go in that direction, which is a marvelous thing. Right, so the protein can never determine what your DNA is like, what your chromosomes are like, or the information in chromosomes. Proteins can't determine how genes and chromosomes are put together. And that's a really good thing, because tonight when I go home and have a chicken dinner, I don't have to worry about waking up with a beak or feathers, right? Because information doesn't flow that way. It only flows what? DNA, RNA, protein, just like so. And it has two steps. You got to know the names of these steps and where they occur, right? So two steps. The first step we call transcription. That's converting information from DNA into RNA. You've heard that word before. I'm not sure you can apply it to this lesson, but where have you run into that word, transcription or transcript? What's a transcript? Transcript. Okay, you've probably taken some classes here at this college or other places, and there is a record of what classes you've taken and when you've taken it, what kind of grades you have, and sometimes your employer might want to see that if you're applying for a job or another school, and they ask you for a transcript. And what is a transcript? Does somebody sit down with a pen and copy that information? No, it's just a photocopy, right? So a transcript is a photocopy. It's pretty much an exact duplicate of the information that's on that piece of paper. So this RNA is almost the same thing as DNA, but not quite, a little bit different. Right? We said if we lose DNA, if DNA gets lost, damaged, what happens to the life of the cell?
Yeah.
It dies. If RNA gets damaged, what happens to the cell? Does it die? It doesn't die, because if the cell needs this information, where can it go? Back here to DNA and get it. So RNA is just a working form of that information. If it gets damaged, that's okay. It can be replaced with information that's in DNA. Right? And so that's just the instruction on how to make this protein on a ribosome. So what I want you to know about the central dogma is that information always goes from DNA to RNA, RNA to protein, and it has two steps. First step is transcription, basically making a photocopy. And the second step right here is called translation. And that seems a little mysterious until you really believe that you know what translation means. What does translation mean? Where might you find translators? Where might you find translators? Language. I like that. Language. A translator knows a couple different languages. And a translator can take information in one language, convert it into another language, but what about that information? Should he change the language? Should he change the information?
No.
No. Information is the same. What's different? Just the language is different. That's translation. Same thing for this second step in protein synthesis. Okay, what's the language of proteins? That's amino acids, right? Amino acids is the language here. The language for RNA and DNA are not amino acids. They're called nucleotides. Nucleotides. All right, so translation takes information from nucleotide language and converts it into a amino acid language. And when you go take information, don't change it, but change from one language to another, what do you call that step? That is translation, the second step in protein synthesis. Okay. I think that's all I need to talk about with that. Well, maybe one other thing. We might talk about this. There's more than one kind of RNA. Okay? I've got three on this slide. There's ribosomal RNA, and guess what it makes? Ribosomes. It makes all those little factories, right? Those little workbenches where proteins are made. There is a messenger RNA. It's a really long molecule. It's like a dictionary. It tells the cell how to spell out a protein. Right? So it tells the cell, put an amino acid here at the first position, another one at the second, and third, fourth, fifth. It's like the dictionary on how to make a protein. That's a messenger RNA. And of course, a ribosome, in order to make a protein, what does it need? What's the building block of a protein? Amino acids. So ribosomes, things have to be delivered to them, and the thing is amino acids in order to make a protein. The thing that moves amino acids from around everywhere in the cell to a ribosome is what we call a transfer RNA. A transfer RNA is a way that amino acids are brought to a ribosome so that a protein can be made from them. So when you see tRNA, like I see right here, that's transfer RNA, you could think of taxi RNA just as well. Now you could even talk to me, taxi RNA, that's fine, but don't talk to anybody else. It's taxi RNA. And don't tell anybody else that I told you that's what it is. Okay? It's just not one nice way to remember. All right, so those are some kinds of RNA. And you know, what molecule is used is necessary for translation? What's the building block for translation?
Amino acids,
yeah, because proteins are made by that step. Okay. All right, so that is protein synthesis. Oh, one other thing. What is step number one again? What's step number one?
Transcription.
Where does that take place? It always takes place, transcription. Inside the nucleus, because here's that nucleus, there's something that can never leave the nucleus, and that is DNA, right? So transcription has to start inside the nucleus. That's where it takes place. What about this second step? What's the name of that second step? Translation. Where does that take place inside the cell? In the cytoplasm. Yeah, so now you know a lot about protein synthesis. Where it takes place in the cell, okay, what the building blocks are, and that tells you a lot about protein synthesis. Okay, two steps. We now know that sometimes RNA can be converted into DNA. There are certain viruses that have genetic material in the form of RNA. Once they infect your cell converts that RNA into DNA with the help of that virus. It's called a reverse transcriptase. That's reverse transcription. And we used to think it didn't ever exist, but it does exist. And a really good virus to remember that's an RNA virus that can reverse transcript is AIDS virus. Is like that. Okay? So it can be very common. Mitosis. Yeah, we talked about mitosis a bunch in lab. Remember mitosis? I have interphase right here. Is interphase an active form of mitosis? It is not, right? It's just the normal part of the cell cycle where the cell is doing its job. It's maybe making more DNA. It's making proteins. If it's an endocrine cell, if it's a gland cell, it's making a hormone that can be secreted. When the cell is ready to divide, it starts in prophase, then moves into metaphase. What's Can you tell me a characteristic of prophase? What's one characteristic of prophase? Oh, I like that. I like that. Let me put this away. Let's come over to here. Prophase. Okay, so remember, DNA is a big, long filament like this. Take all the DNA out of your body, all your cells, string it to end to end from here to the moon. Really long, which means it's really fragile. So when the cell's not using it, it has to be protected, right? So it gets wrapped up. So it's wrapped up around these histones, which are proteins, and then it forms more wraps and more wraps. So this is extended chromatin that can be used for transcription in particular, which is what the first step in protein synthesis. And when the DNA should be in a protected form, it's wrapped up into this chromosome. So it's DNA and proteins and a whole bunch of stuff all put together. This is the safe form. And you can even see these chromosomes, and you did, underneath a light microscope. All right, so that's a chromosome. This is condensed chromatin. Here is extended chromatin. That's what happens during prophase. Right, with another thing, the nuclear envelope starts to disappear, like I see right here. And you see chromosomes here? Indeed you do. And here is that nice micrograph. Right, and metaphase comes right after prophase. What's one nice characteristic of metaphase? Yeah, because they're attached to microtubules, what can these chromosomes do? Since they're attached to that railway system, they can get moved around inside the cell, and indeed they line up all at the equator of the cell, which I see right here. That's a nice metaphase illustration. Here is a metaphase micrograph. And remember, these pictures are in your textbook. They could be on the first practicum. Right? That's what we're going to rely on a lot, on that first practicum. Not so much microscopes or micrographs that you see underneath the microscope. And anaphase. What's happening in anaphase? Yeah, these chromosomes here start to split in two. This chromosome and this chromosome are identical. It's not that we're ripping apart a chromosome in half. Right, so there's one set of chromosomes that go up over here, identical set of chromosomes that get pulled down over here during anaphase, and then telophase. Here's the last phase. What happens during telophase? I think of maybe a couple things. Okay, nuclear envelope starts to reappear. The cleavage furrow develops. And the cytoplasm then gets pinched into two separate cells. And maybe even some of this condensed chromatin is extended again so that it can be used. Right, that can happen too. All right, what is it going to say? Okay, this cleavage furrow is going to separate cytoplasm into two separate cells. That has a name too, that process of separating cytoplasm into two locations, two different cells. What do we call that process? Cytokinesis. And in this class, we're going to say cytokinesis always happens in telophase. That's good enough for us, right? Okay. All right. So if you want to think about the difference between cytokinesis and mitosis, what's one way that I think of it? And I like this way of thinking of it. I think I told some of you. Cytokinesis is what? The separation of cytoplasm into two separate cells, cytoplasm. And mitosis is? It's the separation, not of cytoplasm, but of genetic material into two separate cells, right? Mitosis, separation of genetic material into two separate cells. Cytokinesis is separation of cytoplasm into two separate cells. Okay, that happens with the process we know to be cytokinesis. Yeah. Oh, you got to speak up just a little bit. I have a microphone. Late prophase. Nuclear envelope disappears. Chromosomes attach to the microtubules that have been assembled across where the nucleus was. Okay. In early prophase, that extended chromatin that goes all over the cell condenses into a chromosome. And the microtubule system begins to form. The centrioles start to split apart and go to opposite ends of the cell. All right, so I don't want to make a distinction in this class. I'm happy if you know IPMAT, which stands for what? Interphase, prophase, metaphase, anaphase, telophase, right? I don't care about early or late prophase. That's not too important for me. Okay? But that's some distinction. Well, you saw all these interesting organelles, and they have different shapes, which means what? They have different functions, right? All right, but your cells are loaded with them. Okay, why do you have so many organelles inside of this cell right here? Why are we burdened? Why do we have to build all these organelles? Right, we just learned a lot about them, and they're there not just to make our life complicated because we have to learn about them, but you could think about that for a second. Okay, why are they inside the cell? Okay. I'm told I should wait just a little bit. 1001. Yes?
They all perform different functions.
I like that a lot. The organelles all perform different functions. Okay. So when I look at this cell right here, I think of this building. How many classes are taking place in this building? Just anatomy class?
No.
There's astronomy, there's math. Probably not English, but what else? Some physiology, some molecular biology, all kinds of math classes, okay? And let's just say we had a building and it only had one room. And all of those lectures were taking place at the same time. Maybe a couple math lectures, a couple physics lectures, maybe a circuits lecture, a couple biology classes, chemistry, right? I think that would be really great because you could come into this building and get a college degree in just one semester. Right? Because you can learn all that information at one time. Why hasn't somebody thought of that already? You're shaking your head no. You think that wouldn't work? Why wouldn't that work? Too much information. This is true. Okay? But if somebody right now came in here and started lecturing on math and I was lecturing biology and we're talking at the same time, I agree. It's a lot more information, but what else would be happening? What I was saying would overlap what the other person was saying, and maybe you can even understand what I was saying. Because whatever I would do here would inhibit what you could hear from the other person, especially if there were like 10 or 20 classes, right? So one class would inhibit your learning from another one. They would interfere with each other. One class would interfere with another. How do we solve that problem? Putting rooms inside a building. So I can teach anatomy here without interfering with physiology next door or chemistry next door, physics over there, right? So that's the job of these organelles. Not only do they perform different functions, but they're in a special area so that when a mitochondria makes ATP, they're not disrupted by rough endoplasmic reticulum. These organelles can go about and do their jobs independent from each other, more or less, right? Without interfering. So that's the reason why we have all these organelles inside the cell. Okay, I think that's good for this chapter. Any questions on this chapter? Okay.
The cytoplasmic and the cytoplasma the same, right?
Cytoplasmic is an adjective that we use before a noun. So we want to say vesicle. So here's a vesicle. If we say cytoplasmic vesicle, that means that this vesicle is in the cytoplasm. It's modifying our understanding of what a vesicle is. Okay, cytoplasmic, adjective. And the other one you said was what?
Noun.
That is probably a noun, I can't remember. Cytoplasm is the stuff. Yeah, is the stuff. Yeah, so we'll learn that there are a lot of substances and sometimes we'll talk about it as with its name, but sometimes there's a substance that's close and we got to tell it that it's close to this other kind of thing, so we put an adjective in front of it. And the way it's spelled changes as well. Okay? Like there could be a protein, and that protein could be mucus. And we could say mucus, or we could say a mucus protein, and the spelling is different. For instance, here's a membrane. And we could say, well, since this membrane is secreting mucus, it's a mucus membrane. Mucus is adjective to membrane. And mucus is spelled differently. I'll tell you guys that later on. Okay. All right, chapter 2. What about chapter 3? Ready for chapter 3? Indeed, no, because we're not going to cover chapter 3. That's good you did your pre-lecture reading assignments. And I think I have them here, so we're going to progress right to chapter 4. And where's chapter 4? here it is, chapter 4. All right, so I'm boring you guys a lot, but that's okay if you get bored, because that really means you know it. What's a building block of life once again?
Cell.
A cell. And a cell is a building block of?
Life.
Ah, no. Cell is a building block of life. And if we put a bunch of cells together, what are those cells? Those cells are a building block of a tissue. That's right. So a tissue is a whole bunch of cells. And those cells all have pretty much the same function. They're all doing the same thing. Ah, which also means what? They have the same. But if they all look the same, they have the same structure. I like that. They have the same structure. They all look the same. Which means what? They have the same function. Okay, so that's what a tissue is. All the cells kind of look similar. They have pretty much similar kinds of functions because they're built the same way. That's a tissue. Like most contractile cells in the heart, those muscles, cardiac muscle, they all look like cardiac muscle, right, for instance. You have cells in your brain that send electrical information very rapidly, long distances. Those are neurons, right? And they all kind of look the same. They have the same shape. Guess what their function is? They're all the same, okay? Okay. All right, so we're going to look at these tissues. So it's just a group of cells with similar structure, which means similar function. And also, in some tissues, the material between the cells, we call that extracellular material, is the same as well. All right, so there's a lot of sameness going on right here. And histology is the study of tissue structure, and of course, then that means function as well. All right, people that had lab today are relieved because they know how many basic kinds of tissues are there. There's only four. All right, so you point to some part of your body, it's really easy for me to tell you what it is and what its possibilities. Epithelium, connective tissue, muscle, or nervous tissue. So there's only four kinds. So in your mind, from here on out, no matter where, if you're working or taking another class, you got to remember, how many general kinds of tissues are there?
Four,
because you're going to really understand disease processes and treatment possibilities by tissue types. So you should always be categorizing things by its tissue type. All right. Epithelium. First one we're going to talk about, here's one thing. Here we have epithelium, and we add a connective tissue to it. Epithelium and connective tissue, two different kinds of tissues. Put them together, what do we get? A membrane, right? So a membrane usually has both of these components. And so, if we put tissues together, what do we get? An organ, right? So you could think of this membrane as an organ because it has two different kinds of tissues. But nonetheless, we're going to talk about it in this chapter. Okay. Epithelium has some characteristics. It covers surfaces of the body, or it can line cavities. Do I have that? Covers surfaces. Well, the inside of a cavity is what? Covering the inside surface of something. Some really good examples will be your skin, right? That's covering the surface of your body. And gastrointestinal tract is a tube running through your body, and it has a covering on the inside, and that covering is lining the tube. We call that an epithelium. And the inside of that tube is just what we call the lumen of the tube. The inside of that tube is a lumen. And here we have a blood vessel. It has a lining as well on the inside. That's an epithelium. And the structures of these epithelia will change, which means that the structure of these different epithelia in different parts of your body changes as well. And the inside of a blood vessel contains blood. That blood is in what part of the blood vessel? We call it the lumen. The interior space of a tube is the lumen. That's where we find blood in the blood vessel. Epithelium forms glands, maybe not all glands in your body, but many, many of them. Another characteristic, it has very little extracellular material. When, what kind of material is that? Where do you find extracellular material? Outside the cell. It hardly has any at all. So since it hardly has any extracellular material, it's mostly cells packed tight together, close to each other. And since epithelium lines the surface, it's kind of like a sheet. So it's got two sides. The side that's pointing toward the lumen or that free space, we call that the apical surface. The other edge of that epithelium that's connected to the rest of your body, we call that the basal region, right? It has two different sides. And here's something strange. It never contains blood vessels. Because there's no room for blood vessels because these cells are packed together so tightly. No room for blood vessels. Maybe you've got a paper cut sometime in your life and it's done really bad and you go, oh geez, I better cover it up and I don't want to look at it. And if I don't cover it up, there's going to be blood all over the floor. It felt really bad. Right? Then you get some courage and you look at it and guess what? What's happening? Nothing. It's not even bleeding. All right? And so that's a characteristic of epithelium. It doesn't contain blood vessels, but it can have nerve fibers in it. Right? So you've got a nerve, feels really bad, but no hemorrhage. Yeah. Sometimes it is not alive. And I think in lab last time I said we needed some cells to look at. These cells that make up your skin, that's an epithelium, they're so far away from blood vessels, all of these cells have been dead already a long time. So I'm just looking at a bunch of dead cells. But I know underneath is what? A living organism. Okay? Yeah, but those cells do die. If there are many layers to an epithelium, as they move away from blood, they start to die. Yeah. This is true. And some other characteristics change in them. They get stronger and harder, which is okay, because then our skin is really strong on the top. That helps abrasion a little bit. All right, well, we want to be able to classify an epithelium. So I'm going to talk about some of this stuff. I'm going to show you this first, almost first. I want to show you this first. Okay, so here are two ways that we can classify an epithelium. There's a system on the left over here, and there's a system on the right, A and B. I see two different columns of information, graphical columns. Right. Let's start with column B. That's a good place to start. Sometimes cells are flat, and a word for flat is squamous. Right, so these kind of look like pancakes or a fried egg or something. They're wide and they're deep, but they're not very tall. They're thin and flat. That's a squamous cell. Sometimes they're wide, but they have the same length in terms of depth and the same length in terms of height. No matter how you look at it, it's the same length. And so we call that cuboidal. And then we can run into cells that are as wide as they are deep, right? But they're really tall compared to those other two dimensions. And that reminds us of a column, right? So those are columnar cells. So when we talk about epithelium, we want to say what kind of cell type it is. That's one way. The second way that we classify is by number of layers. So remember, we said that an epithelium has two surfaces. It has an apical surface, which on my skin would be the one that's facing out. This is just a free space that has nothing in it. That's the apical surface. If we look at the inside, right, go in past the cell, then we get to the basal surface, which is right here. That's pointing towards some interior part of your body. Apical surface is pointing toward the outside. And if you count the number of cells from the basal surface to the apical surface, how many cells do you count from here to here? I see one. If there's one layer, we call that a simple epithelium. What about this one right here? Here's the basement surface, and here's the apical surface. How many cells do you see? One, two, three, four, five, maybe depending on where you look. But nonetheless, it is always true there's more than one layer. More than one layer is called stratified. All right, so to completely characterize an epithelium, we have to tell somebody how many layers it has and what the shape of those cells are. So a simple squamous epithelium, do we have a simple squamous epithelium on this slide right here? Right here. Right? One layer, squamous cells, simple squamous epithelium. Okay. If it is a stratified epithelium, we notice that the cells have different shapes. Depending if whether they're on the basal surface or the apical surface, it changes. Right? And the way that we name this epithelium right here, or all epithelium, is by the shape of the cells on the apical surface, not the basal surface. So if we look at cells down here on the basal surface, what would be one way you could talk about these? These look cuboidal to me. Okay. And what about these at the apical surface? Squamous. Okay. All right, so your choice is squamous or cuboidal. We name by the apical surface. So this is a squamous epithelium, even though I see cuboidal cells down here. But what else do you have to say? How many layers? How many layers is this? Yeah, many layers, which means stratified. More than one, stratified. So this is a stratified squamous epithelium that we have right here. Nice, easy one to see. Okay. Okay. Let's maybe look at some cells that we have. You're going to be looking at these things in lab for the next, this week and maybe a little bit next week. All right, so here we see some cells. Cells all over the place. Here's a nucleus inside one cell. Here's a nucleus down over here. This right here is a tube. And it looks like a circle. All right, consider this pen. The pen is a tube. There's ink on the inside of it. Depending on how we cut this pen, it's going to look different underneath the microscope. Right, if we have this pen and cut it straight in a transverse section like this, when we look at it on edge, what does it look like? Does it look like a tube? It looks like a circle. Okay? All right, so sometimes tubes can look like circles underneath the microscope, or instead, if we cut it like this, will it look like a circle? No, it's going to look really long. It's going to have two sides to it, and it's going to have an empty space in the middle. What do we call that empty space in the middle, again, of a tube? That's the lumen. Yeah, the lumen of that tube. All right, so here is a tube, and this has been cut in a nice transverse section, right? So you're looking at it on edge just like that. Here is another tube, but how's this one been cut? More in a longitudinal section, okay? So these are just artifacts of preparation. Sometimes you see nice round tubes like that. This is really nice to see. And how do I know this is an epithelium? Well, I see this dark line right here. That's the basement membrane. And then I see some stuff here with really no cells. Right, so here is the lumen of something, of a tube. Right, so this means that this is the apical surface of these cells. And what did we say? What kind of tissue lines a cavity or covers a surface? Epithelium. So here's an epithelium, right? It's making up the wall of this tube. And how would we classify this epithelium? First, let's think in terms of layers. Basal surface, apical surface right here. How many cells do you see? One. So it is a simple epithelium. What about the shape of these cells? This one kind of looks good. This one here looks good. Where it's like, it looks pretty good. Okay, look at these right here. These are columnar cells? No, these are cuboidal cells. And so this epithelium, then we can classify as being a simple cuboidal epithelium. Something else that's really important. Things that connect these two tubes together so they don't move around is all these cells between the tubes, and indeed we call that connective tissue. That's one of the designations that we're going to look at. That's one of the four main kinds of tissues, connective tissue. So we have epithelium here, and then connective tissue, and in some slides you might even see muscle and nervous tissue as well. Right, so you just have to look around. Nonetheless, this slide right here is a perfect example of a simple cuboidal epithelium. All right, so on a practicum, I'm going to use these figures that are in your book. I'm not going to have you look through a microscope for all the particular questions. So for all purposes, you really have a microscope at home because you have your textbook. And on a practicum, I might erase these things right here, and you should be able to label these lead lines. Like these cells right here between the tubes is connective tissue. What is this thing right here, this small little dark line? Basement membrane, so that's the basal surface, there's the apical surface, and then these are what? These are the simple cuboidal epithelial cells. Okay. When you start looking at pictures like this, something that you should automatically look at, or it will just be obvious to you, and if it's not obvious, you probably have to look around for it. What can you tell me about this basement membrane I see here, and this basement membrane here, and even here? Is it kind of smooth and continuous, or is it rough and jagged, maybe with rips in it, cells coming out? Smooth, right? Basement membrane should be smooth and continuous. If it has breaks, right, or if it's rough and jagged, then that means that there's some kind of pathologic process happening with this tissue. Maybe it's cancer breaking away. All right, so everybody likes to look at these basement membranes, and that's why you see it on almost every slide in the textbook, okay, basement membrane. And it's what, pathological basement membrane or normal?
Normal.
Normal, that could be you, all right, because it's what, smooth and continuous. I don't have any, this is not a patho anatomy class, so I don't have any pathology to show it. But we could, if we wanted to see some pathology, some histology that's pathological, what could we do? How did we find, yeah, how did we find cheek cells in a lab? Just Google it, yeah. Question.
So, in looking at these pictures of white blood cells, to be able to distinguish, like, the cuboidal shape, do you just look for one that are more distinguished, like the ones on the right side? Because I feel like I might have a hard time with some of them, because, you know,
I don't. I understand. You'll have to practice. And we practice in lab. Okay.
Like the one on the right, like the perfect.
Okay.
Like the one
down, right? Oh, here. Yeah. Yeah, so this picture in your textbook is classic. Somebody sat down and looked at 1,000, 2,000 cells, microscope slides, and said, oh, this is probably the best of all of them, and took a picture, put it in the book. All right, so you're just going to have to practice looking at these kinds of tissues underneath the microscope. They're all going to have different artifacts in them, right? But eventually you'll train your eye to see those. But the other good thing is, I can't get too crazy. I can't get too carried away, because what's going to be on the practicum? This picture right here. Okay? So you have hope. Okay? You do have hope. Maybe not so much in lab, when you have just a random microscope slide, but then call me over. And I'll bring it to you, a piece on that slide that looks like this, and guess what you're going to say? You're going to say, oh. Okay, question. You're going to say, oh, I see it, is what I meant to say. Yeah. Maybe not. Because I don't see a lot of different cells right here. This is mostly just secretions. It's mostly just kind of connective tissue. Okay. I'm going to talk about some other membranes. Like your skin, sometimes we call that the cutaneous membrane. And that has epithelium and connective tissue in it. That is the kind of membranes that I'm talking about. Okay. All right, let's look at another. Oh, before I leave from this slide, what about these cells right here? Are they far apart from each other, or are they touching each other? They're touching each other. No room for a blood vessel, right? They're all touching. Okay. What about here? Is this epithelium? Are the cells touching each other?
Yes.
Indeed they are. No room between them. Here's the basement membrane. Down below the basement membrane is going to be connective tissue. It's not on this slide, but that's where you'd expect to see it. What about the shape of these cells? Oh, we should jump right out at you. Columnar. And how many layers from the basement membrane to apical surface?
One.
So it's a simple columnar epithelium. And not labeled on this slide is the lumen of this particular tube. All right, so you analyzed that one pretty fast. What about this one? And I'll give you a hint. Here's the basement membrane right here. So here's that free edge. There's nothing out over here. The rest of your body is down over here. And this is connective tissue down over here. Yeah. That one or this one? This one right here. Simple, because from the basement membrane to apical surface, I only see one cell. And this thing here is not a cell. What is this? This is a nucleus. And it just so happens they all kind of line up really close to the basement membrane. But nonetheless, all of this is cytoplasm of that living cell right there. So it is columnar. I'm going to talk about that one in a little bit. Here's a pretty easy one. Here is the basement membrane. Here's the apical surface. How many cells? One? One cell? More than one. So it's a stratified. And what's the shape at the apical surface of these cells?
Flat.
So it's a stratified squamous epithelium. Our skin is a pretty good example of that. But we looked at these cells, right, last week in lab. These are cheek cells too, right? And we can scrape some of these cells off with a toothpick, look at them underneath the microscope. Some of them look not so good, because maybe these are dying too, because they're moving far away from blood vessels that are down here in the connective tissue. I don't see any blood vessels up here. That's not its job. And when these slough off or fall away, then they're replaced with ones down below it. And then eventually these are the living cells that replace all these cells up over here that break away. All right, so stratified squamous epithelium. Here's a tube cut almost in transverse section, but not quite. Here's the center of the tube. That's the lumen. All right, and then here's the basement membrane. Does this look like a nice healthy tube? Yeah, to me it does. Right? And how many layers from the basement membrane to apical surface?
Two.
I see one nucleus, I see two nuclei, right, on top of each other. So this is not simple, but a stratified cuboidal epithelium. Pretty easy to see. Maybe not the first time, second time, third time will be really easy. All right. What about this one? Basement membrane right here. Look at these cells by the apical surface. Are these squamous?
They're
columnar. And there's a cell underneath it, so it can't be simple. So here is a stratified columnar epithelium, connective tissue down below. All right. Ah, okay, I'm going to talk about that one in a little bit. Here's one. Okay. I don't have a picture of this one. But here is that lining of a blood vessel. What do we call the inside of this tube?
Lumen.
That's the lumen of this blood vessel. It has a lining of these cells right here. And I don't know if you can see, but how many cells as you go across this lining? There's only one. Okay. And the shape of these cells are squamous. So here's a simple squamous epithelium. It lines a blood vessel since it's inside the blood vessel. Instead of an epithelium, which really means on top, we call that an endothelium, which means what? It's inside something. Right? So an endothelium is an epithelium that's inside of a tube like a blood vessel, for instance. And it has some special properties. Right? It not only lines the blood vessel, but it lines the inside of the heart. All right, let's go back to this one right here. So you guys now are developing a little bit of an eye for epithelium. So here we have basement membrane. Underneath is connective tissue. All right, but here is, and then here's that free space, right, maybe with nothing in it. And now what about this? What can you tell me about this slide? How about layers? Certainly doesn't look simple, except maybe in one location, maybe like right over here, I see a cell that can go all the way down to the basement membrane, but sometimes I see three, sometimes I see two, right? And so we can't really make up our mind what kind this is. And if that's the case, we call this pseudo-stratified, right? Pseudo-stratified. And these cells are what shape on the apical surface? Yeah, so pseudo-stratified columnar. And these are those special surface specializations that I didn't have on that nice illustration of a cell, but we see it here in a micrograph. These are cilia. What's the job of cilia again? Yeah, motility, and they're sweeping, right? They're not, these cells aren't sweeping, they're not moving, but whatever in this tube right here is being swept in the direction that these cilia are beating. All right, so what the heck? What are they sweeping? Well, here's another kind of cell. This is a gland. Remember, glands are made up of mostly epithelium, but it's only one cell. This is a unicellular gland, and its name is a goblet cell. The job of a goblet cell is to secrete mucus onto the surface of this pseudostratified columnar epithelium. And that mucus is kind of slippery and smooth, but it's also kind of sticky. It can trap particles like dust particles and bacteria and things like that. This kind of epithelium we find in your windpipe. The anatomic name for a windpipe is trachea. It connects your oral cavity with your lungs, so you have air going through that passageway all the time. And that air you breathe, is it sterile? No, it's loaded with viruses, bacteria, dust particles, hopefully not too much of any of those things. Some of those particles get trapped in that mucus secreted by a goblet cell, and the cilia sweep it. They sweep it up, right? So they're sweeping it up. Which way do they sweep it? Up into your mouth or down into your lungs? Okay, they sweep it up into your mouth, out of your lungs, because you don't want your lungs to fill up with mucus and bacteria and garbage and stuff like that. All right, when it's in your mouth, then what do you do with it? Swallow it down. Get rid of it. Unless you're a baseball player, then you can spit it out, even during supper time, right? But otherwise, no, you just swallow it down to get it out of your lungs. All right, so here is a pseudostratified ciliated columnar epithelium. We're going to start there next time. There's only one other weird kind of epithelium that you have to know about. Read about that before Monday. Here's a sign-in sheet. Here's your receipt that you're in class. And don't forget, here's your contact information for SI. Monday signing sheet.